Since we might not be able to get any of the other facilities till 10 o'clock, I wonder if there might be a few people here who'd like to hear part of my story. We don't like our speakers to be overworked. You know, it's sort of traditional when you're going to introduce a speaker. As soon as he gets here, you try to get up with him and find out a few things about him. Well, I got up with him, and I hadn't seen him since a while ago. I was privileged to meet him at the airport. And I was late getting there, and I'm absolutely honest with you and myself when I say it wasn't my fault. And the plane was already in. Now, I'd been told that he was with a fellow that I could easily recognize. But I knew him, and I didn't know what he might do if he got there and there wasn't nobody there. Then I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know whether to go have them paid, and I thought that might be embarrassing. I found out the plane had been on the ground about 15 minutes. And it just dawned on me to go toward the baggage section. And when I started down that narrow passageway to the baggage section, I looked down there and I saw one of the most beautiful little things I'd ever seen in my life. And I said, she's got to belong to an alcoholic. Julie, would you stand, please? Running down there, and I saw this other nut, and he spoke my name, and he said, "Here's John," you know, very affectionately, and Julie turned around and said, "I'm Julie," and then she introduced me to Sandy, and we got in the car and came back to the motel, and I hadn't seen him since, till a while ago. But I knew when I met him that he was one of us. There's no doubt about that. And we won't go into that. But I asked a few people who knew him and found out some things about him that I'm going to let him tell if he wants to. Won't you join me in welcoming Sandy?
Thank you, John. Good evening. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Hi. I'm very pleased to be here tonight, and I do want to thank the committee for asking Julie and I to come down. I think it's just been a fantastic weekend so far, and after a short lapse tonight, I'm sure the pace will pick back up again tomorrow morning and when Eddie gets up here, but we'll get through this. I came into AA on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964, which is an appropriate day for me to come in anyway, and I haven't been drunk since that first meeting. And it's, during that time with a rough sponsor like I had, I've been to many, many meetings, a lot of closed meetings. I've heard an awful lot of people talk. And I'm convinced deep down in my heart that there's, just without any qualification, that I owe all of that to not drinking. I am personally convinced that is the reason that I haven't been drunk since that particular meeting. I like to mention that not drinking part. A lot of times we get rolling along in here, other areas of sobriety. And there was a lawyer who used to live up in Washington. He moved down to Alabama and passed away recently. But he was a great hero of mine when I came into the program, Charlie B. And he had a thing about the steps. And his secret to working the steps was, when all else fails, don't drink. And, you know, because I really try hard on those steps. And I'm hanging in there every day. I got the little book you read in the morning, the one you read at night. And I got little notes I carry around. I got pamphlets that I got in my pocket at work. I still have days when I just hang on. And, and I sit around, you know, and I'll, with these basic training that I had, I'll start with the Serenity Prayer. And I find that it upsets me. And I go, you know, and I think everybody has those days. And that's the day when you fall back on the real basic training here. And that's that not drinking part. I really am a big believer in that. I think it's fantastic. And I mention it here. I know that most everybody's heard of it. But there may be someone new who just got dragged here under the pretense that this was a political convention or something. Goes, oh, I'll go. And you're brand new to the Fellowship of AA, and you're sitting here, and, geez, I hate to be the guy who lets the cat out of the bag, but that is a fact. Not drinking is... that really is, isn't there? And also, if you came out of the mental institution like I did, you got to forget some of the slogans that you had up there. I remember one, I was up there over the 4th of July, and we had on the blackboard when the psychiatrist came in, give us Librium or give us death, you know. And, I had that feeling that I didn't like to go anywhere alone. Couldn't imagine coming up here alone. I mean, gotta have your friend inside to keep you company so that you would go out there and face all those people alone. I do want to mention something. I was, have really enjoyed the weekend, and I was greatly, moved when I heard our Al-Anon speaker, Louise. I just, it's been years and years since I've related to a story like that. I just wanted to thank her because of how much good it did me. And we have, our stories are so similar. And here one's an alcoholic and the other one isn't. And a lot of times we don't get that close realization that people are people and we have our problems and we have this sort of common solution that we have in here. But we came in 1964. I was thinking of all the similarities that she was going along. Came in 1964 and went through one of the most difficult periods of my time in the program was after 8 years in the program, going through a divorce. I thought I was going to be thrown out of AA. You know, I figured, oh, your whole, the family must be doing something wrong. You're doing the steps and all the guilt that came in. I figured I'd be rejected and all that. And it helped me put it into words. So whatever she said, that's what happened to me. That explains how the... Because I have never been able to get this out correctly in words, and it just was said so well, and I thank you so much for it. You helped me with my problems today as I sat out there this morning, and I really appreciate it. It was just marvelous. The other thing I was thinking about before I get talking about my childhood, which I love to talk about, is... I heard an observation about AA that I think is interesting. There's no nostalgia in AA. You ever notice that? Every other organization, everywhere else I was, you were always talking about the good old days. You know? You don't hear anybody in here going, boy, you remember the convention 2 years ago? That was a real good one. You remember back when I first came into AA? Boy, it was great back then. It gets better all the time in AA. That's why there's no nostalgia. Well, we love our past and we love our history and it's fun to talk about it, but not in the same sense we used to talk with nostalgia about a past that really didn't exist, about those wonderful times that were back there. The only reason they were wonderful was they were over. And it's great. It's great that you never hear it about in AA, the nostalgia, how great it was years ago. Because we're growing, and our lives are getting better, and we're learning. And if we don't, we die. It's very funny how that works in the program. That's the other thing I wanted to mention in connection with that not drinking, just to get back to that in case there is that one new person. That reason is because of this death angle that's connected with the not drinking. They call it the fatal nature of the illness, and I had a sponsor, you know, and they put these big words in the big book. They try to slide it in very cautiously to not scare us when we're brand new right out the door. But my sponsor helped me with that. He said, what do you think this means when it says we learned the fatal nature of our illness? And I can remember telling him, well, in my opinion, it's quite obvious what that means. It means in certain cases that there are people whose allergic reaction to the chemical alcohol may be of such magnitude that under any given condition, possible that certain organs within the body cease functioning, and there is sort of a demise, or whatever you call that. And he said, no, I want you to check that page again. Look at it real close. What it says is, Sandy's gonna die. That's what it says in there. It says, oh! And that's the thing that gets you involved, is when your name is in there, you know. Alice is gonna die. Where does it say that? I gotta see that. And then that caught my attention. I don't think I'll stay around another day. I think I wanna hear more about this. And so I think that's the way I look at the program. If I had to sum it up, I really, you know, just not drinking, that gets us going, in my opinion. Of course, anything I say is just my opinion, which I don't think anybody else would claim anyway. But I think that it works kind of like breathing and living. It's obvious that we have to breathe in order to live. But on the other hand, if all there was to living was breathing, I might quit. You know, what the heck? Sitting around hearing that noise. And that's it. And, you know, the funny thing is, all along the way, I suppose as a certain amount of time went by, if all there was to sobriety was not drinking, I might quit. And that's what I think AA tells us, that we have to stay alive, and we do that through not drinking, but that gives us the chance to work the 12 steps so that we don't return to drinking. And this has sort of been my little way that the program evolved within me. And I think it's true. We may hold on to that, just don't drink and go to meetings. Check your brain at the door. That's terrific in the first month or two, but if you check your brain at the door 5 years ago and haven't gone back to get it, I would hate to embarrass you by asking you what in God's name you think that slogan on the wall that says think means. You probably have that one turned around. We do have to go back and get our brains and end up with the know the members' eye view where they talk about maturity. I love that guy. I wish I had a chance to meet the guy who wrote that pamphlet, The Members' Eye View, where he talks about maturity, where we finally are willing to make our own decisions and stick with the consequences. And I think that's when we do have to think our way through problems and get our advice from other people. But that's part of what the steps can give us. But returning to my childhood, which I think is important. I didn't used to talk about my childhood. I thought, what the heck, you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. All you have to talk about is when you started drinking. You might as well start with your first drink. And I'll tell you why I like to do this. And I did this during the first 5 years that I was in AA. Because I operated under a certain assumption. And my wife has a quotation about assumption, but I'm not going to repeat it. I operated under this assumption. All of my problems were caused by my drinking. So as soon as I stopped drinking, the job was done. Everything would return to where it was, and I would go on from there. Now, this may be okay for a small percentage. I've never really calculated the percentage where this may, in fact, be true. But in my case, I didn't have anything going good before I started drinking. Life had me so confused I didn't know where I was going when I poured alcohol in. And the simple removal of the chemical left me where I was when I started drinking, which was a skinny, nervous teenager wandering around, what in the hell's going on in this world? And that is where I kind of got left off. But I didn't like what the implications were if I admitted that my problems were not necessarily caused from drinking, but were aggravated by drinking. Because if that was the case, that meant I had to take the steps. That meant I had to dig into those 12 steps and do something about those problems that were there before I started drinking. And they came about, I can only look back on them the way I saw them, through the eyes and ears of a little kid, and who knows if that's what really happened, but I know that this is what really came into my head. And I come from New England, and I think my parents basically, like a lot of New Englanders, were raising me to be a snob, which is, this is one of those things, may not be a big thing down here, but up in New England, that's a big thing, to try and be a snob. And it takes a certain poise, and you try and get a certain look on your face, sort of, disdain was one of our more popular words, and that type of thing. My problem was that people frightened me, and I was very nervous about being around other little kids, and I had a problem keeping up this stuff, so I had to pretend. I became, early on in my life, I was a pretender, and one of the things I pretended, and I think all alcoholics end up doing this, is to pretend that everything's all right, because if everything's all right, then nobody's going to question you. Nobody's going to come in and find a weakness, a chink in your armor. And it soon became apparent that it was a tough world. It was a dog-eat-dog world. Everybody's out to get you, and you have to sort of be your own person and build a good defense around you so that the rest of these people that are pretty mean, tough, out to get you, can't get in, can't penetrate this thing. So as I was growing up. But I knew that behind all this defense was nothing. That was what I was afraid would be disclosed at some future date. There was just a little, like the Wizard of Oz, that little old guy back there. And that was what I was terrified about. And under those conditions, I was to meet God. Now, I met God at about age 6 when my parents said, we're going to now let you learn all about God. And I was brought into the Catholic Church. And nuns came out. And I sat a little 6-year-old kid in that front seat. The rest of them are where the kids are waiting for this thing to get over with so they can go play baseball. But I didn't have any thoughts about baseball. I looked up there with my eyes about this big around and started hearing about it. And they said, hello, little boy. We're very glad to have you here. And we're going to tell you all about God. God is love. But God is everywhere. And God knows everything. And we want to tell you something. You're in trouble. You're in serious trouble. You have original sin. And I went, oh, wow, is that bad? And they said, is it bad? That's a stain on your soul that'll get you into hell if we don't take care of it. We have other sins, and I heard about all of those sins, and I heard about what happened, and I heard about Judgment Day, and I heard about punishment, And I heard about all these things, and my eyes got bigger and bigger, and I walked out of there just after a few weeks realizing that I was in serious trouble. I had a terrible problem. My future was in great jeopardy, and I developed a terror of God, and it just came through wrong. So many of my friends got support and got this proper perspective and the wonderful relationship with their religions and their churches, but it came through to me as this terrifying experience that I had to, again, keep a secret. And in my own little mind, I knew by age 12 that I had approximately 75,000 years to do in purgatory on stuff I had just thought about doing. I hadn't even, you know, done them. And I can remember, I kept going, we got to stop those thoughts from creeping in there. This is, and I thought, okay, no, I'm thinking like that. There's like a cash register going off in there with all these years building up. And I've got to do something about this. And the last thing I wanted to hear about was, and then you're going to meet God. And I'm going, wrong. This is a terrifying experience for me to meet God. That's when we're going to get the scorebook out. Knew everything. And I was just so uptight about this whole situation, and I couldn't understand the joyous feeling that other people had, so I had to make some assumptions about it. Again, never communicate with other people, just make observations and try through some form of introspection to understand what was going on. And the only conclusion I could come to was, none of them sinned. That's why they were so comfortable and happy. And little did they know, in their midst, they had this horrible little boy who had all these terrible secrets, and if they ever found out, I knew they would get rid of me, that I would be ostracized from them. So I had the terror that this secret would be out. And I went through life developing horrible little secrets that I was terrified that people could find out about, and I had to pretend that none of this was happening because I was trying to be a snob. And this became a terrible conflict as the teenage years approached. One of my best friends and closest things that I held to my heart was guilt. I just had guilt all the time. It seemed like I never did anything right. I had developed a conscience that was my constant friend. You did it again, didn't you? Well, you did it again. And it was just in there. Conscience got tired in later years, and that was replaced by my wife. You did it again. The world, in other words, was a very frightening place for me, is what I'm trying to tell you. I did not have any close relationships with people. Of real friends, I had no knowledge. I was afraid to let people get to know me. And when conversations got real personal, I felt frightened by it, and I just would move on and change it. Developed some sort of a sense of humor. Let's joke about it. Could not bring myself to really talking about how I really felt about things, because I was learning that a real man solves his own problems. A real person does not ask for help, because asking for help is a sign of weakness. And I got this from church, from family, from books, from movies. How many of us remember those Western movies where the hero lived alone in the desert with his horse? And when there was trouble in town, they would send for him. And he would come in and put on those black gloves in the bar, have a couple of shots of whiskey, and walk out wherever the trouble was, bang, bang, get back on his horse and go out into the desert, and the town people would go, oh, who is that man? What a wonderful thing. And that was you know, sort of perfection. That was the goal to strive for. And I realize now how unusual it is to live alone in the desert with a horse. But I never questioned it then. I only saw that as sort of the ideal. That's what you could look up to. And that's what I was looking up to. So I found the world frightening. I found my existence kind of terrifying, and I didn't have anything to fall back on. I didn't really have a spiritual foundation to fall back on. I really didn't have any principles for living that I could fall back on. And if you don't have the fellowship of anyone else to talk to, you end up rather lonely. And you end up a sort of a frightened, lonely little kid in a hostile world where all you saw was those tough eyes of other people. And you know, the world, if the world's hostile in your head, that's going to be a hostile world, because that's where it exists. And so I ended up in college up in New Haven, and which is my hometown. And I was there, and I hadn't had a drink yet, and I was keeping some pledge of some sort. And I found that the pressure of the peer group, and I'm greatly subject to the pressure of the peer group, which is good, because that's why AA works, is that great pressure of all of us on one another to do this together. And I was a natural-born follower, and I like to follow where somebody come up with an idea. And I remember attending one of the first social functions, and there was about 50 people in the room, and I felt that normal feeling whenever I entered the room, which was that all eyes turned towards me, and they were saying, "What's he doing here?" That was a typical feeling I had when I walked into a room. And there was that look in their eyes, "Why is he here? What's he doing here?" And I just felt totally uncomfortable, and I picked a drink up off a tray as it went by of some sort of whiskey and poured it down, and found that that chemical had no reaction on me whatsoever. I recall no effect on me. But I noticed that the eyes of the people in the room took on just a different tone. That hostility seemed to, it was amazing. I can remember looking out very closely into the eyes of the people, and there was sort of a warm exchange of glances that was going on. And, you know, that was the kind of world that I liked. I remember loosening up a little bit when the way these people were now treating me. So I had another drink, and I waited a while, and I noticed that the room became very warm. I just sensed it, that these people weren't like all of those rotten people out there. This was a warm, caring group of people that I was now in. And they were motioning to me, "Hello there, hi, boy, we're glad to see you here." Some of them wanted me to talk to them. They wanted me to tell jokes. They wanted to know my name. And I'm talking to them and smiling and shaking hands. And I'm saying to myself, this is what life is all about. This is the kind of the way the world really ought to be, instead of all those mean people out there. I'm so grateful to have found this crowd of people. I'm so glad to be in the confines of this room. And I remember alcohol changed my world. It didn't change me. It changed my world into the kind of world that I wanted to live in, where people cared about each other. You talk about Christianity in action, there it was on that first night of drinking. I had a spiritual awakening. I was at peace with my fellow human beings. I was at peace with myself because I saw that these people accepted me so I could accept myself. There was that wonderful feeling, and it lasted about an hour. And then I started throwing up. You remember how that, always in, I could sit down about 5 minutes if I leave the throwing up part out of the story. I spent so many hours in the morning and practicing, and there was just tremendous amounts. The night was a horrible night. The next day was horrible in classes. I got a sampling of the disease of alcoholism. It was almost like somebody was saying, "Look, we're going to give you fair warning about what alcohol is all about. We're going to give you a little taste of everything during the first 24 hours." And I think I really did get. I had sort of the throwing up, the dry heaves. I had some of the cold flashes, the hot flashes. I had the itchy skin, a couple of twitches. The stomach doing that stuff. I had sort of the general cross section, like a smorgasbord of all the things that I was going to get to know very good in the years ahead. I had just a little sampling of all of them, and it was awful. It was a terrible experience, and at the end of the day, the next day, the crowd of these guys came back, and we said, "Hey, we're having another get-together. We'd love to have you come over. We're going to drink again. Be sort of like last night." And I can remember my body said, "No." I mean, every organ in the body said, no, 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 veto, that's out. But at that particular time, my brain was in charge. It was going to lose control soon, but at that moment in time, my brain was in charge of this package. And the brain sat up there intellectually and said, wait a minute, let's not rush into this. Let's not make a quick decision. Let's evaluate the facts. Let's step back and look at this situation. On the one hand, we had what? Little illness, little headache, not feeling too good, you know, a few of those little pains. But on the other hand, we had that hour. We had that hour yesterday when all was well. And if we sit back here and truly put values on these things, we will come to the conclusion that that pain was a small price to pay for that hour. And I thought about it and I said, you better believe it was. And I went out and had the drinking. And as the years went along, the hour got shorter and the pain got worse. But the formula kept coming out even. It kept coming out that this is a small price to pay for all the fun that I'm having. And as the time went further along, the equation went something like, this is a small price to pay for all the fun that I think I'm having. And I would have to check with people who were with me the night before to verify that I had a good time because of the blackouts. And I would say, geez, I've been in jail. I had my teeth knocked out again, and I feel awful. Did I have a good weekend? And then I'd get a lot of people who were there. You know how you try and coax them through reliving the weekend, pretending that you really remember it. Yeah, you remember we went on, and then you hear, and then, wow. Try not to look shocked. And at the end of the recreation of the weekend, I would say deep down inside myself, well, thank God I did have a good time because I paid a hell of a price for it. And that was, and I had a problem when I came into AA with the second step, with the sanity concept. And my whole thinking, all during my drinking years, went along like that. And I think we have to rationalize like that, because if we don't, the question of stopping drinking is liable to raise its ugly head. If this really wasn't worth it, then why do we keep doing it? So I had to justify it. Somehow I got through school and I got into the Marine Corps, which was a wonderful place to drink. And I ended up being a pilot. It was some sort of a hobby. I don't know how I really got into that, but that was what I did for most of my drinking years. Was in fighter squadrons and photo squadrons and flying around in single-engine jets and thinking that I was just the most exciting person in the world. What a wonderful life. And that's the end of that. There's nothing else to really tell about that. Just get back to the drinking. Because that is what I really was an alcoholic. And I had a hobby of being a Marine pilot, which... Because a hobby is something you give about an hour a day to, and that's what they were getting. And the rest of the time was spent recovering from the night before and getting ready for the next night and covering up lies and keeping notes. Okay, I did this and all of the things that it takes to be a practicing alcoholic. And the action in the disease of alcoholism occurs on the inside. This is where all the action's going on. And our little careers and our little endeavors that we have going on, whatever they are, U.S. senator, housewife, writer, laborer, whatever those things, that's sort of the background music to the disease of alcoholism. The actions going on inside here where all the fears are building up and the resentment and the distortion of the reality and the inability to ask for help. And this fighting, this battle all alone and hiding in there and pretending that nothing's wrong and just fighting this struggle and knowing we're going to lose and pretending we're not going to lose. And God, what a rat race that was. It's all taking place inside and we can't share it with a soul. Terrified to share it with a soul lest anyone find out that there's a chink in the armor and they could penetrate and go inside. As the years went along, I could remember I would never look anyone in the eyes. I had heard that the eyes are the mirror to the soul, and that someone might be able to see right in there. And I was just so afraid that it could happen in a strange city. I might be walking down the street and just happen to make eye contact with the wrong guy. And he would look right in there and he'd go, "Arrest that man, there's no one inside. There's an empty shell walking around the streets of this city. Get him off. We only allow real people here. We don't want phonies. We don't want people who have nothing left inside but fear and terror. We don't want that kind of person." So I had to keep this a secret and always pretending that everything's all right. I think pretending that everything's all right is one of the hardest parts of being an alcoholic. Pretending that you're fine when you've just thrown up to start the day and you come out and throw that mouthwash around in there and slosh around and go out and just attempt to keep track of what you're supposed to be doing, and the confusion and the loss of the awareness part of the brain and all of those things that were taking place was a terrifying experience. As the years went on, I became a daily drinker. And I like to remember this process, because I did not intellectually become a daily drinker. I didn't sit around the house one day and say, "I think the in thing these days is vodka for breakfast," before going down to the squadron. I didn't think that. The way I became a daily drinker was because of the physical progression of the disease. I can remember sitting around at my desk, and it would be 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had a lot of paperwork to do in the squadron. And I was looking at the clock, knowing that at 4:30, I might venture over to the old club for some friendship, possibly have a drink while I was there, and go on home. And my body started sending little messages up from the stomach. Just little things. There were raw nerve endings down there. There were strange little hot flashes that were accumulating. And there was sort of a whole basic message that was coming up from all of the organs of the body to the brain. And the message was, "We'd like to start drinking a little earlier today than normal." And the brain would look around and make sure nobody heard that or was aware, because this was like a terrible, awful thought to come surfacing like that. And the brain was going, "We can't get out of here at 3 o'clock. There's a bird colonel sitting over there. There's a general just up the hall. What am I supposed to do? Get up and say, 'I'm going to go get a drink'? We're staying here till 4:30. And the body would say, "Wrong. Take a look at your right arm." And I would glance down and there'd be a couple of spasms and just, I had never really experienced that. And there was sort of like I was being a hostage in my own body. And there was this threatening message, like, "That's just a warning. That is just a hint of what's going to happen if we don't get booze down here." And, you know, this sort of developed over a period of time, but there was this threats, these little innuendos that kept coming up. And finally it got stronger and stronger, and so I had to rationalize it. I had to explain it. I always did that when I was going to do something irrational. That was the definition of rationalization, was a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior, you know, and so I had to explain it. And so I explained it to myself. I saw a guy who was on leave one day having a drink in the afternoon. And I said, "Geez, I didn't know that these guys drank during working hours here." And finally there came a day that I did leave maybe an hour early and lied about where I was going just so that I could get the drink in a little bit sooner. And I had compromised on a position that I would never drink before 4:30 during working hours. I had just compromised that much, and I felt awful about it, but I knew it was a necessity. It was a physical necessity in order to continue at my job. And even then I had to pretend that it really wasn't happening. And the body was just quivering for the chemical. The nerve endings were that raw. And I was in the car driving over to the club, went up to the bar, and the bartender comes walking up, and he sees me every day, you know. And I said to him, "Don't wait on me, go ahead and wait on him. I'm not in a hurry, I'm just going to meet somebody here." And then I stood around, and my body is going, "What the heck are you talking about, that you're meeting somebody?" It was like the dog in the Alpo commercial. You know, Ed McMahon, they don't feed that dog for about 3 days, and then they hold that dog food up there, and there's that shaking and the quivering, and his eyes are like that. That's what was going on in all of these nerves and organs in the body. It was just shaking because the eyes were telling it that the booze was right there. The eyes were sending the message down throughout the whole body. The vodka's only a foot and a half away. And the news was spreading throughout the central nervous system. Our time is near. And there was quivering, and there was excitement, and there was anticipation. And it was just this, and yet I had to pretend. Wait on him. I'm not in a hurry. I'm just going to meet somebody. Well, I guess he's going to be late, so go ahead and give me a triple vodka martini on the rocks, and let me have it. And I got the glass in both hands and looked around. I was always terrified that people were watching my every move. And picked the glass up and got about 3 big swallows of that vodka and carefully put the glass back down and stood back away from the bar and waited. Because I knew what was going to happen. It happened every time. It was just a matter of seconds before that vodka raced down into those legs. And those muscles that had been spasming all night. It was like a massage. It was like solid muscles again. And suddenly I felt like I was standing there like on firm foundations. Standing in front of the bar, looking in the mirror, watching the whole recreation of a healthy human being taking place right before my eyes. And it came up into the stomach, which had been on fire since early morning, just vomiting, dry heaves, and it was just like awful. And it came up in there like a cool foam and moved across the stomach and just went, whoo, and I went, "Oh, God. Oh, does that feel good? Stomach is at peace." And then like lightning, it raced out the arm down to the fingertips, and they just became steady as a rock. And at that moment, I would light a match to have my cigarette in case anybody was watching and thought I trembled a little when I picked up the glass. And I looked around lighting the cigarette to make sure everyone saw. I didn't have any trembling in those hands. They felt just as solid. I could write my name again. And then last but not least, the vodka swirled around for a second, building up momentum, and then raced into the brain. And that brain had been so terrified and addled and confused and frightened and all of the horrible feelings, and it just came sweeping across my head like this, and it just went, "Peace!" And I stood there. And I just stood there looking in the mirror and going, "What was I so worried about when I came in here? I must have a tough job. I must have a pressure job like you hear about. This must be awful. Isn't it wonderful that a guy with as many problems as I have has a friend like alcohol? Isn't it wonderful? What would life be like without it? Can you imagine going through the world feeling like I did when I came in here without alcohol to calm me down and to give me that wonderful peace that I so richly deserve? Anyone who put in a day like I did deserves a drink." Little did I know that the drinking was causing the day that I had just put in, and that alcohol for me was like insurance in reverse. If there's any insurance salesman, I propose that there is such a thing as reverse insurance. Where you work very hard for some money and you take a certain amount and you walk into a liquor store and you hand over $3.62 to a man for an absolute guarantee that your tomorrow will stink. And that's the funny part, you know. The practicing alcoholic says he's drinking because of his uncertain future. He's the only one whose future is certain. It's going to be rotten. There's no doubt. There's no possibility it could be rotten or could be good. It's going to be rotten. Practicing alcoholic would just have to say, how's today? He says, bad. Tomorrow's going to be worse. That's your future. And it's a guarantee. I feel fortunate that my body gave out as I got into daily drinking and was overseas and so on down. I feel very happy that my body gave out before my brain went all the way. There's obviously been, something happened up there. And I ended up in a nut ward. And then this happened, I won't go through how it happened, but it was a convulsion. Seizures, whatever you call those things. I was attending a career school at Quantico, Virginia to become the next commandant of the Marine Corps. And I had gotten ready for that school by not eating for a year. And I had malnutrition. I'd been drinking daily for about a year and just shook and got lost going to school. Got lost. I couldn't find my locker and I could never find my seat in the room. It was just an awful month. And one day my body stood up as if to ask a question in class and just convulsed. And a seizure. And those things are difficult to have on the QT and just pretend, oh, I'm just just fooling around over here. Nothing serious. Don't pay. That's when it becomes difficult for the enablers, as we call them, to continue enabling us. When we're lying there with our tongue biting, you know, and they're going, what is that? And the stretcher comes in and they go out. And I can remember hearing from friends of mine who were totally honest with me. The guys in the room went, what's that guy's serial number? And they were figuring whether they moved up a notch or not, you know. That really was a dog-eat-dog world. There's many bird colonels in the United States Marine Corps that never would have made it without me. I made them look so good by comparison that they had to get promoted along the way. And they owe me a great bit of gratitude, and someday I may get it from them. But I ended up in the hospital, in U.S. Naval Hospital in Bethesda, and then promptly went into the DPs, which explained the convulsions, and I went to, I don't remember much of this, but I was out for a week or something, and needles going in, and in a bed, and I woke up, and I was in a bed with sides on it, like a crib. And very confused and looking around and hurting. And someone had wet the bed that I was in, lying in. Which... Which, by the way, is something I have not done since I've been in AA. Is wet the bed. That's funny how we... Boy, that's hard to explain when you're 30 years old, man. Try laughing that over and turn the mattress over when those things. Damn cat. Oh, hell. You gotta stop laughing, I'm never gonna get through here. Huh? Oh, wow. And this wasn't funny at all, I just got through telling you. I'm lying in this bed. Oh, wow. Anyway, it was, an awful period of time physically and mentally. But I was introduced to AA. And a corpsman marched us down to an AA meeting, and I sat there resenting it greatly. I hated it. Just the idea that these men were strangers knew that I had a problem, you know, that I was worried about my image. And after the meeting, I went up and talked to the leader, a red-headed fellow from Bethesda, Maryland, told him what a marvelous program I thought he had. Typical snob. I was still trying to be a snob, locked up in the mental institution. And said, I've evaluated what you have to say. I think it's fantastic. If I run into a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him around to see you. That was the first thing. And I can remember what he said. He poked me a couple times in the chest, and he said, let me ask you a question, buddy. Which one of us is going to put his overcoat on tonight and go out and get in his car and drive on home to his family like a regular person? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe on and go in the elevator and go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? Now, which one are you? And I resented that man for a long time. I resented him in the elevator, upstairs, hanging around, group therapy, clay class, everywhere. I resented that guy. And the reason I did was because he had told me the truth. I didn't like the truth. That's one of those weapons that you just don't use on people unless you don't like them. Tell someone the truth like that, right when you first meet them. But there came a time when I was very grateful that I had been forced into that particular AA meeting, because 4 or 5 months after I was released from the hospital, and I did drink again for 3 days, and in that 3 days, I got right back in the same kind of condition I was in when I was admitted. It only took just a matter of a day to get right back into shaking and drinking around the clock and being afraid and so on down. And I knew I had to go back as an outpatient up to this mental institution on Monday, and so I called over the weekend and dialed in a group and said, help, help, I need prime, oh, help, please. And they sent a huge man over to see me, a big Marine. And he filled the doorway of my house. I can remember that. And he came in and he said, hi, my name is Bill. Now, this is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen. There was that immediate relationship was established. And it still exists. His proposition was, okay, I see you have a drink in your hand, pour it down the sink. And I said, yeah, but I got to pour it down the sink. I said, yeah, but it's my house, pour it down the sink. And then he said, give it to me, I'll pour it down the sink. Boom! And it went down the sink. And I'm going, this is a strange relationship we have here. There's a, I'm losing control of the situation. Right in my house. And he said, okay, I'm going to stay here and watch you so you don't drink until 8 o'clock tonight, and then we're going to go to a meeting. He stayed and talked, and then he got my wife in. And she was telling all this stuff about how I drank in the morning and was a patient and this thing. And it was awful. So he took me to a meeting, and I was at my first meeting sober. I'd been sober about 6 hours. You ever been in a meeting sober 6 hours and your body is just screaming for a drink? And the meeting was a group anniversary. It lasted until about midnight, dancing, ham, turkey, everybody, more ham, more turkey? And I'm going, get out of here. I'm going to throw up on you. You get away from me with that ham and turkey. But my sobriety had just started and I didn't know it. I was calculating when I was going to get my next drink, and I haven't had it. For some unknown reason, when I got home that night, that man said to me, okay, you don't drink. I'll pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Goodbye. And he drove off. And I was just going to explain to him what a busy social schedule I had and all those things. And I was terrified to not drink, and I was terrified what would happen if he came around and smelled booze on my breath. I just... You got to see him. I'm going to start carrying a picture about as big as this book, so that I can a slide, so I can flash it on, and then I'll say, "See why I stayed sober? I stayed sober for a month out of fear of sponsor." And he just had me there. And as time went along, I sat at meetings, and I knew I didn't belong there. I was just there temporarily. I was just there until I figured out what was wrong. Because a grown man and a real man figures out his own problems and never asks for help. And some of you may have heard that if I can get the Walt Disney Studios, we're going to put together a little comedy routine, and it's going to show the death of an alcoholic, like the death of a salesman, only this one is going to be done in a toilet bowl, 8 feet in diameter. And we'll have the appropriate music, and we'll let the guy walk around oozing self-pity for about 20, 30 seconds in front of the camera. Then he snakes a speech to the world and gets up on the toilet, takes his last drink of vodka, jumps in, pulls the chain. It sounds like Niagara Falls going there. Pulls the lid down, and just as he's going down under, he says, "At least I didn't chicken out and ask for help."
Boom!
And goes down. And that's the end. And that's our alcoholic. That's the... That's the personality that I remember. Where an alcoholic lying flat on his back in the street feels superior to the people looking down at him because it is secret potential that we have inside. The potential that we've never unleashed on the world. That wonderful potential we all had that we're just going to unload someday. We're going to get up and show all those people that have been spitting on us and kicking us and turning us into losers. One of these days we're going to do it. But today we're not going to do it because we need to drink. That's the type of attitude that I brought to AA. And I sat out there knowing you had nothing to give me, knowing that I would just buy some time and eventually I would have to figure this out myself. But in spite of that attitude, just sitting at meeting after meeting, in spite of this defense that was in front of me, I began to have some hope that what you had, I could get. And I started really relating to the people who had what this 12-step refers to as the joy of living. Geez, they kept showing up with that laugh and that smile, and they're going, "I had a hell of a day today, but I got through it, man. That's all that counts. It's your attitude towards the day." And I'm going, "Are you kidding? What do you mean here? That's all that counts?" And they were consistent. I would see them week after week, and they had that sparkle in their eye and that feeling, and there was just no way to deny what was going on in those rooms. It went on night after night, and I started to be a part of it. I didn't want to be a part of it. I didn't plan to be a part of it. But it started getting me, and I was coming there, and I dared to hope that this could happen to me. You know, it takes a lot of courage to even hope for something good to happen to you when you're an alcoholic, because you've had your hopes dashed so many times. Failures become part of our life. We adopt the philosophy of the born loser. I'm never going to win, so why try? I was born under some bad signs. Yeah, I'm born under some bad signs. Vodka label. And it's a great negative outlook on life, you know, going down. Well, that's well-deserved. It's proper. The facts support a negative outlook on life. But somehow at these meetings, that attitude was being changed. And the big thing in the beginning that was changing it was not drinking. Not drinking. More time of sobriety. More proof that I could make it through another day without a drink. More days going by. And eventually I started wanting what the people had, and I heard about the steps. And I knew that that was all the people that I wanted to be like always talked about the steps. They were the ones. They always attributed, they said, "What I got, this joy of living, all of this, these real good feelings inside came from the steps." And I said, "That's what I got to go after." And I went and got the books and I started reading about the steps. And then I saw in there, it said, "All you have to do is totally get rid of all of your old ideas and turn your life over to God." I went, "Oh, we have a problem." We have a serious problem in my case. And I got my sponsor in there and I said, "Hey, we got a problem here. Let's turn my life over to God." I said, "You know who God is?" And I started telling him, you know, purgatory, 257,000 years minimum as I figured it now. He's been waiting for me for years. I've been running, hiding, trying to get, but he's everywhere. He knows everything. There's nothing I can do. You want me to turn my life over to him? And he said, "Wait a minute. We're going to get a miracle out of you on this third step. A miracle is going to take place in your life. Forget about your childhood interpretation of God. You're a grown man now. We're going to learn about a new higher power. We're going to learn about a loving God. You're going to learn about it through the results. You're going to feel what God is like. You're going to feel his presence in the changes in your life. All you have to do is begin this step, and we're going to have a miracle take place." And I said, "All right, what am I going to do?" And he says, "Why don't we have you turn your life over to whatever will take it?" So, all right. We won't worry about the definition or having a picture or his biography or anything like that. You just turn it over to whatever will take it. And then we'll have the miracle. Now I'm going, well, it's a miracle. He kept talking about the miracle, the third step. And I said, well, what's the miracle? He said, the miracle, Sandy, is that if you turn your life over, we will remove the management of your life from the hands of an idiot. And I can remember, I felt like I'd been had. I felt like, what a joke. What a thing. And it was almost with that proper snob disdain that I threw the mess in at some group out in Manassas, Virginia. Said, you guys want it? You want to run this mess? Go ahead. I'll watch. But I'm going to be critical. I'm going to be standing here watching every day. And I've been standing back most every day watching. And, you know, I really appreciate the job, you all been doing, and, I thank you very much. It's incredible what happens when I stop being in charge. I get in there every so often just to see what it's like. Oh, boy. That brings back the memories of how awful it was. But that step was marvelous. That did offer a wonderful beginning, and, the second part was getting rid of old ideas. Old ideas. You know, and I couldn't believe, how could I part with my ideas? And if you're new, I'm sure you're saying, what do you mean, part with my ideas? I thought up all these ideas. This is the real me. I have, these are my values. This is my whole thing. You want me to get rid of all that? Right. That's all we want, is for you to get rid of it all. All. The whole package. Start all over again. There was an analogy portrayed one time of a flower growing out of a flower pot. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and I said, oh, I get it. The analogy would be that we yank the flower out by its roots, and then we take it over to the fertile AA soil, and we replant the flower, and it blossoms and lives happily ever after. And he said, wrong. Wrong. We yank the flower out by its roots and tear it all up and throw it in the garbage can, and then we grow a new flower up out of the dirt. I said, that deep we gotta pull out old ideas? He said, that deep. I went, oh, that's gonna take a while. He said, yeah, we got a lot of steps to help you. We got steps about inventories. We got steps about interpersonal relations. We got steps that'll get you in there so that you can find out what all those old ideas are. So that you can get your together and put it in a bag and we can throw it away all at once. And that's the way I look at it now. What a release. I think that's the big release in the program. It's almost like you're out there with 50-pound stone on your back. And that's the old ideas. And you're in the sea of alcoholism. And AA throws out the life preserver. And you grab it and we start pulling you along in this ship of the journey of sobriety. And we're saying, drop the rock. And you're going, I don't want to drop the rock. And we're going, but you're barely staying afloat. And you're saying, I know. And we're going, drop the rock. I can't drop the rock. It's me. It's the real me. I can't possibly. Finally, in desperation, you're going under and you throw the rock away. And it's like a water skier coming up on top and you just skimming along with the rest of the program. And you stand there going, wonder why I didn't drop the rock sooner. What did I want that rock for anyway? What do I want that for? You know? Why was I clinging to those ideas as if they came from God or somewhere? Well, I guess we were our own God, so we might as well hang on to those old ideas. The last step I want to touch on before I sit down is the one I'm plugging this year. And it's the one that'll end our isolation from God. I consider this the most selfish step for me in the program, and that's step 8. Little old step 8. Hardly ever gets plugged anywhere. Thought I'd plug it down here before I sit down. Made a list of all the people we'd harmed and became willing to make amends. I want to make a plug for the list. I'm not becoming willing. I just want to throw a plug out for the list. I think that has given me as much insight into myself. It's been an exciting trip. The discussion in the 12 and 12 is the most exciting reading about how we can go back over interpersonal relations. I think us alcoholics, if we have one problem, it's other people. Wow, is that a problem for me? Is that a problem for me? That is probably my main problem now that alcohol has been removed. Other people. How am I going to get along with other people? And the funny thing is, that could be the obstacle to really getting close to God. I think that's sort of an avenue that Bill W. talked about in ending our isolation from God. So I'll throw a plug out for that step. And if a last little word for someone new, this is what I think happens at these wonderful conventions and meetings and everything throughout the country, is that there comes a day, and it may happen this weekend, where you suddenly realize, deep down inside your heart, that you personally have finished that long, lonely journey of alcoholism all the way down, and you're going the other way. When that day happens, it's impossible not to smile. When you know, just inside, from your very soul, that you're all through going down and you're going the other way, you can't stop smiling. You may look and say, wow, it's a long way back up, but you know you're going in the opposite direction. You're going the other way, and you want to run down the street just telling people, hey, I'm going the other way. I'm going the other way. That is one of the greatest feelings in the world. And the second greatest feeling in AA is you took the trip down all by yourself, but you will never be alone again. We go back up together. We learn what a beautiful feeling it is. To put our hands out and tell somebody, I just went through that spot myself. Louise took me through a spot this morning. That's what I'm talking about. When we listen and we share and there's someone out there and you get that feeling, oh, he went through it, she went through it, I can do it. I'll go talk to him after. And you grab a hand. And this is how sharing works. And this is how God wanted it to work. So if you're new, just let it work and we'll all be sitting out there someday looking at that smile on your face, looking at that sparkle just radiating out of your eyes, and we'll know that it worked again. Thank you.